The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on this week's program is Kathy Ruby, and the subject is something very dear to my heart, having put three kids through it, college funding. Now, what our subject of discussion today is going to be on the program, before we get our guest on, is getting more and more coverage in the press. People are waking up to this, and that is why more Americans are actually ending up broke, not necessarily when they start out in their retirement years, but later on in their retirement years. Nobel laureate Robert Merton has called it America's new retirement crisis. And the fact remains that more Americans are heading into retirement every single day. The tragedy is that many of these retirees will end up impoverished or broke in their latter years. Hardest hit especially will be women, due to the fact that they are likely to live the longest. As Americans, we're living longer. That's the good news. The bad news is, well, you need to live off your assets over a longer period of time. The problem is the three-legged stool for secure retirement remains absolutely in doubt. Pensions are no longer guaranteed. And what you have in your 401k is what you get. That's it. Defined benefit pension plans are going the way of the dinosaur. Social Security and Medicare benefits are being reduced, and investments don't return what they used to, because as retirees, they must deal with the lowest interest rates in history. Then there is the impact of inflation over a longer number of years spent in retirement, and that is going to continue. And you add it all up, it's no wonder that more Americans are ending up impoverished in their later years. And in all fairness, Jim, you have to admit that a lot of people getting ready for their retirement are actually swimming uphill against all of this stuff.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the whole retirement environment, which we'll get into in our discussion today, we talk about this three-legged stool, Social Security, pension, and savings. Well, you know, your father and my father worked in their career. Most of our fathers spent an entire career working for maybe one company. That was back in the days when they had defined benefit pension plans that covered close to 70 to 80% of their salaried income when they were working, and then you throw in Social Security benefits on top of that. I mean, it was pretty predictable, and it was a very good time in this country. But all of that has changed. I mean, Social Security and Medicare benefits are being reduced. Defined benefit plans are no longer part of the retirement environment. They're still on the government side, but very few corporations have them today. And then on top of that, we're dealing with probably the lowest interest rate environment in recorded history. Not to mention the unpredictability of markets today that are being controlled by, let's say, central bank policies. So it's been called a retirement crisis. But John, I think there's a better word to describe it. It's a life planning crisis. And the reason we're facing this crisis at all is that over 70% of Americans have failed to plan, not just for retirement, but they failed to plan financially. I mean, when you think about it, it begins the moment you graduate from high school. The decision you're going to make towards your education. Are you going to go on to college? If you are, what kind of degree are you going to get in terms of going to college? Because that's going to determine the profession that you choose, which will determine your earning power over your working career. And then it's also how you're going to finance that education. I think that's really become a bigger issue here that we've seen over the last 15, 20 years. When you take a look at education expenses, have been going up 8% a year. And so when you take a look at choosing your career in terms of your degree, how you're going to work and how you're going to finance that will determine when you enter the workforce whether you start out your working career with a heavy debt burden, as many millennials are facing today. Also, you know, when you think about the size of the debt, the figure is somewhere between $70,000 and $100,000 of student loan debt the average couple brings into a marriage. John, that's something that could take decades to work down or pay off. Not to mention, you know, trying to save up money to start a family or even money for a down payment on a house. So there are a lot of financial decisions that you're going to make throughout your working career. And so this whole retirement crisis that we're talking about, you know, when we think about retirement, oh, that's something you do maybe 10, 15 years before you retire. It really isn't. It begins the day you get out of high school when you decide what it is you're going to do as a career. And as a career, how you're going to educate yourself, what degree you'll pursue, what kind of job you'll have, or for that matter, for many college students, if you will have a job. I was just reading Wall Street Journal article, had an article last Thursday that talked about the unemployment rate for a lot of college students is like 15-16%. So a lot of these students are not only leaving college with a heavy debt burden, but they can't find a job because their skill set in terms of the type of degree they pursued, there just aren't a lot of jobs out there. So it's choosing the right education determines whether you're going to have a good paying job when you get out of school. But John, this is really more about life planning more so than it is, let's say, retirement planning.
Yeah, and the problem is most young couples starting out today are probably not thinking that way. I know when I was young, I wasn't either. You kept thinking, oh, well, retirement, well, that's, you know, way in the future. I'm not going to have to worry about that. I've got 5 centuries to live or something like that. At least that's what you think when you're young. Retirement's not too far out to think about it. And there are other priorities, from paying off student loans to saving for a down payment on your house to actually moving out from living with your parents, which, by the way, is becoming another phenomenon. You talk about increasing phenomena, are multi-generational families living in the same structures. And some house builders are actually designing homes for that now, in anticipation of this new type of move. So you got a lot of priorities to think about. Most couples don't have a defined plan to help them navigate through life. So they end up making poor financial decisions or don't focus on retirement until later on in life when there are fewer years to plan and to accumulate assets.
You know, you brought up a key point. There's been several articles in the Financial Times and also the Wall Street Journal about this new style of building homes that builders are making sort of guest rooms, or like, you know, the option to turn one garage bay into a separate facility. And John, this reflects not only the fact that the kids are staying at home. In other words, a lot of millennials are still at home living with their parents because they either don't have a job or their debt burdens are too high. And it's also the fact that many boomers still are taking care of their older parents because of the subject we're talking about, that they end up broke or impoverished in their latter years. So it's amazing how our capitalistic society, that builders are picking up on this trend of multiple families living in the same structure. But aside from that, I think there are two critical factors that need to be addressed and change the course of any retirement plan. And let's begin with, as I mentioned earlier, education and how it is financed. I mean, when you get out of high school, you go to college, the type of degree you're going to pursue is really going to determine not only the kind of money you're going to make, but also whether you're going to have a job waiting for you when you get out of school. And then also how it's going to be financed. It's one of the reasons in today's program we're going to be talking about financial aid with a specialist in that area, because so many students are leaving college today with very, very heavy debt burdens. The second factor, not just choosing a career in the proper education and how you're financing, but John, also starting saving for retirement immediately. I mean, as you mentioned, I never thought about that when I first got out of college. You know, we were starting a family and our first big thing, and unfortunately, we were able to buy a house based on savings that we both had and the kind of income I made coming out of graduate school. But the type of education you pursue has a great deal when you think about your earning power and the ability to get a job. And it's not just the education. It's, as I mentioned, how are you going to finance it? Do you really want to take on a lot of debt? You don't want to come out of college and be heavily burdened with large student loans that can take decades to pay off. I mean, how are you going to start a family or buy a home if you got $100,000 of student loans between you? And especially when both spouses, both husband and wife, have student loans. And the other issue is to start saving early. I mean, you think about it. Let's say you get out of college age 25, a bachelor's, master's degree. You've got a 40-year working career ahead of you. And obviously, if you start saving early it's going to become less of a burden, and it's going to take less money that you'll need to set aside. And what's more, John, it's very doable. I mean, there's no magic to time and compounding with interest.
Well, you've illustrated this point before. Maybe you should revisit that point again. I mean, most couples don't realize it really doesn't take that much to start aside when you start early, and it does compound over time, over the course of a working life.
No, it really doesn't. And, you know, I like to give an example. Let's just take a round figure because everybody can relate to this. Let's say that you're 25 and at age 65, you'd like to have $1 million 40 years from now when you, let's say, head into retirement. Now, let's just take some historical returns, and we're trying to make this easy. We don't want to have a lot of math. So you want to have $1 million, and let's assume a 10% return. Actually, the market's returned 10% over a longer period of times. Now, if you start out at age 25, you only need to put aside $158 a month. 158, and I think that's doable. At age 35, now you only have 30 years to retirement. That number goes to 442. At age 45, the number goes to 1317, or let's say 1300 a month. And at age 55, it's almost 4900. Now, there's a couple other factors too. The $158 you put aside, let's say in a 401k program, you get a tax deduction for that. The average person would probably save a third in taxes. So the $158 you put away really only cost you $106 because you're saving basically $42 in taxes. And it gets even better. Assume that, let's say, for every dollar you put in your 401k plan, your employer matches you by putting in a dollar, then that $158 and the after-tax savings, John, it's really only $53. So can you tell me anybody that's starting out life at age 25, a couple, can't effectively put aside $53 between the two of them to have $1 million when they're retired? So here's another thought. Assume this. Assume that you do put $158 a month, and it only cost you, with tax savings, $106. Let's assume that your employer matches that $158. Then when you're age 65, you'll have $2 million when you retire instead of $1 million. Or put it another way, if you just want to save for $1 million, you started at age 25 after tax with employer matching contributions, it's $53. The point here is the decisions you make early on in your working career can have a major, major impact later on when it comes to retirement.
So starting with only savings, it goes a long way, and it minimizes your debt, whether it starts with student loans to mortgage debt and consumer debt. So saving and living within your means just makes a heck of a lot of financial sense. Now, okay, saving and containing your budget, what else should you consider? What other factors as you move along life's journey toward this destination?
I mean, it's a bigger story than just, let's say, too much debt or saving. It's more a story about, if you think about it, work and spending. I mean, most of your adult life is going to be spent working in some form or another in a career. So the type of work, the job you have will also determine your income and what you're able to spend. You live too well, you may spend too much. A job and how you spend determines really a lot of what you will actually end up having when it comes to retirement. But there are other turning points or key points along life's journey, and they all involve, in one way or another, spending. Now, we talked about the first major expense, which was when you start out, college. So, you know, deciding to go to college and how you're going to fund it, that's a major expense. And also, it's a major decision. The type of career that you're going to pursue, the degree you're going to pursue, is going to go a long way and determine what your ultimate earnings will be during that 40-year working career and how it's funded. A second major factor is, you know, let's say, buying a home, the size of home, the size of mortgage that you're going to take on. The third factor is the lifestyle that you're going to live throughout your working career. Spend a lot of money, you're not going to save a lot of money. So, John, it really boils down to kind of work and spending. And especially in the latter part of your working career, what will you do to finance your kids' education? Just as this decision process began with your own education and how you funded it, it sort of ends prior to retirement in terms of your own kids, how they get educated, and how you pay for it. So if you look at the big picture, it's really a story about, number one, work. Number two, the lifestyle and spending during your working career, which leads to number three, the amount you're able to save, and four, how you invest. And there's so many key decisions that you have to make. I mean, working, deciding on a major that you're going to take. And the latest story with all the technological changes, people will have three or four companies they'll work for during their working career. That's assuming they don't start their own business, or maybe they end up starting a business. You know, the kind of work accomplishments, advancing your career, what you do to enhance it and make it even better. You know, spending stories, you take a look at major purchases you're going to make in your life, homes, your cars, the cost of vacations, extracurricular activities, your sports, your hobbies, and then also savings, how much you're not only putting aside, what kind of plan you participate, does your employer match your contributions, are you maximizing your pre-retirement savings by using a retirement plan, which is tax efficient, especially in terms of the tax deduction, and not only that, the deferral that you get with money invested in a plan, and then also the type of investments you make. One of the big things that we've seen that changed dramatically after the Great Recession and two bear markets is people all of a sudden shunned the stock market and went into cash, or they went all into gold, or they were all in bond funds. In every single plan, and every study that's done on retirement, I don't care if you're risk adverse, if you are a conservative investor, somewhere in between, should include some form of equity investing. And John, we've talked on this on the weekend program, and over the years, the number of individuals today that have gotten out of stocks as a result of the last financial crisis in the Great Recession. So, I mean, when you sum it all up, if you look at life planning, every individual and couple will face key decisions that will impact their financial well-being and their retirement.
Jim, if you would highlight some of the things that you'd consider when you're making these decisions.
We're going to talk about this in the month of May because it's graduation month. And we're starting that out today with talking with a financial aid expert. You know, you take a look at going to college, your own children, or even yourself. When you start out your college career, do you stay close to home, live at home, which is something we advocate in our 2+2 plan? You go to junior college for 2 years, you stay at home, and then if you have to, a state university, or do you go away? A second decision people have to make, not only as parents or you yourself, if you're starting your college career, do you go to a private school or a public school? In other words, is the extra $100,000 to $150,000 you're going to spend on a private education, is it worth it in terms of lifetime earnings? Working for somebody else in terms of job security versus taking on the risk of starting your own business, going into debt to buy a home or wait several years till you have a larger down payment, which means that you'll have lower monthly payments. Here's one of life decisions, marrying for security and stability or marrying for love, or choosing a job that pays a whole lot more money or one that is without stress. Asking financial aid when you need it, whether it's from parents or in-laws, you know, retire to your dream place or live close to family and friends. Or once again, you know, let's say you get laid off midway through your career, deciding to stay in the same field or go back to school, get another degree, pursue another avenue of employment, or actually taking the risk of starting your own business. I mean, these are just some of the life decisions that we all face, and a lot of times the decisions we make will determine the ultimate outcome of what happens as we get closer to our retirement.
Okay, well, let's assume we have made good decisions along the way regarding work, spending, savings. Is that it? Are there other factors that impact whether you end up broke or impoverished when you enter later stages of retirement?
The first thing you need to do is to plan to realize you are going to spend one-third of your adult life in retirement. Today, they estimate between a husband and wife, age 65, between the two of you, you will spend 25 years in retirement. The other thing is life expectancy has gone up by 20 years over the last half century. It used to be, John, when they started Social Security, life expectancy for a male was 65. Now it's closer to 85. The other thing, the three-legged stool is what you work with when you retire. That's Social Security, some form of pension, or savings. So you need to track along the way through your working career whether you are on course to accomplish the goals that you set for yourself. And the Department of Social Security estimates that most people will need to support themselves with about 46 to 50% of your income during retirement will need to come from your personal savings. In other words, pensions and Social Security no longer provide the same percentages or degree of security they once did. That percentage has gone down, and it's probably going to go down even more. So most retirees will have to deal with the ravages of several things. Taxes, which cut into your income. Inflation, which you will face over a 25-year period of time. Let's put it this way. At a 3% inflation rate, in 10 years, your purchasing power will be cut by a third. At a 3% inflation rate, your purchasing power will be cut in half in 20 years. So if you need, let's say, $80,000 to live on right now, 20 years from now, your purchasing power will be down to $40,000. You need to think about how you're going to deal with that. And it's not just inflation you have to think about. We're also living in a low return environment. As we have talked so frequently on this program and on our weekend show, you're looking at the lowest interest rates in human history. In fact, many parts of the world, they're negative. You actually pay the bank to have your money on deposit. So it's not the same environment that most individuals are starting their working career today, nor is it the same kind of environment for those that are retired. So if you haven't saved enough, you have to think of different alternatives. A couple of things, either working longer, cutting your lifestyle, changing your investment strategy, or it's probably going to end up being a combination of all of these factors.
So if we look at those factors, though, Jim, what ones really stand out as being a determiner of a person going broke in retirement?
I would probably say there are several issues that clearly top the list. And John, it gets right back to a budget and probably medical expenses. I mean, couples really need to have a good working budget when it comes to retirement. I mean, you really need to take a look at how you're spending money today. In other words, if you're still working right now and you've got income coming in, take a look at what you're spending your money on and come up with a budget and say, all right, we're spending this for housing, we're spending this for food, and this for cable, miscellaneous expenses, insurance. Then you need to take a look at, okay, if I retire, what's going to change in that budget? Will they remain the same? Will I spend less? Chances are you may end up spending more, especially in the early phase of retirement when you want to do those things you never had the time to do, like travel or maybe spend more time on hobbies. And you really need to take a look at your expenses and understand that over a 25-year retirement, those expenses are going to change over that 25-year period. Your retirement will have three different budgets. The early phase of retirement, when you first retire, you're healthy. You know, you want to go out and visit the world and see those things that you didn't have a chance during your working career. Your middle years of retirement, when your expenses tend to sort of level out and remain low. And then the latter years, where your expenses are due to increase, especially when it comes to medical. The other one I want to mention, and this really applies to the latter years, but you're not thinking about this when you, let's say, first retire, and let's assume you're in good health when you do, is medical expenses. According to studies, you will end up spending, folks, out of pocket, this is out of your checkbook, out of your savings, between $230,000 and $250,000 on medical. And that doesn't count long-term care. So every budget in retirement should have a provision for at least $10,000 a year you put aside for medical expenses. And you better have some sort of a contingency plan if any one of you, between the two of you, ends up in a long-term care facility, which can run as much as $85,000 a year.
Well, Jim, why do you think that, 70% of Americans don't plan or have any kind of a financial or any kind of a retirement plan? And it's becoming more critical to avoid dying broke or ending up being a burden on your kids at the rate we're going. But like I said before, you're also streaming uphill as you try to do this.
Yeah, I think part of this, John, is our education system. And, you know, colleges are great at training people to go out and make a living, have a profession. But the education system teaches people how to make money. Unfortunately, they don't teach you how to manage the money you make. In part, it is also due to the financial industry, which, you know, you talk to most financial people, they're talking about the markets, investment returns. The financial industry itself needs to do a better job on educating clients and helping them make better life choice decisions, whether to send their kids to private school or public school, whether the kids stay at home or go away to school, room and board, making decisions on a type of home to buy, the mortgage you can sustain, your savings rates, the type of investment choices that you make. Most Americans, unfortunately, don't begin to think about retirement until their late 40s or, let's say, early 50s, when the kids have grown up, you put them through school, they're educated, and now you're empty nesters. And you think, oh, great, we got that out of the way. Now we can focus on ourselves and our retirement. The problem is, by the time you start doing that, you could be 15 to 20 years away from retirement, giving you less time to save up that money. And we all know the magic of compounding. The sooner you start, the better off you're going to be. Just like that example I gave you, when it only takes $158 a month, probably $53 if your employer matches and tax savings, if you start out at age 25 versus, let's say, waiting till you're 45 or 55.
So if we sum all of this up, if you're trying to figure out what you should be doing as far as retirement, number of key points. Start at college, both your career and your finances. Start saving early is point number two, all right? Point number three, it's about work and spending. Make sure you have a good budget that allows you to set aside a certain amount of money for retirement. Number four, make good life decisions. And this is pursuant to what I just said. College funding, home and mortgage, your lifestyle, and especially your kids' education. Now, as far as planning, plan for medical expenses during retirement. Number six, recognize that the expenses will change during your retirement, largely going up. Number seven, make up a budget. The budget's the anchor document, so to speak, that you use to provide a frame of reference for everything else. Number eight, make sure the budget is funded. Nine, make good decisions for investments and Social Security. And number 10, plan for longevity. So that's basically the theory, and if you follow it, things should go well. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be talking to Kathy Ruby about college funding. That's an important decision in the life of your children. Usually, if you're starting out, you're going to have to think towards that. But first of all, we're going to do our lifetime income study, where we do a real world study based on a real life case study. We change the names of the people to make sure their privacy is protected. So who are the people?
This week, it's the case of John and Judy Nelson. John is age 66. Judy is age 59. Both are retired. And once again, this is going to emphasize making those hard decisions when it comes to retirement. Now, unfortunately, they retired, in my opinion, too early. John received Social Security of $14,964 a year, and that is their only source of retirement income. Their living expenses have been reduced to $35,000 a year. Unfortunately, when they started out retirement several years ago in 2012, they were drawing $48,000 per year from a joint account to cover their lifestyle. And part of that was due to expensive vacations like cruises and beach house rentals for the whole family. The unfortunate thing is what was once a $600,000 portfolio is now $380,000. Now, when they came to us, you know, we basically said, look, this isn't going to work. And if you keep drawing down this kind of money and spending this kind of money, you're going to be broke. And so the big decision was they downsized to a house and they paid cash for it because they didn't want to have any mortgage. So they currently own a home that's worth close to about $400,000. Now, a year ago, they met with an attorney. They got a will completed with the power of attorney and medical directives. And when they came to us as a result of the planning process, they realized they need to make changes. And I think one of the big things is when they started out retirement, the first couple of years, 2012, 2013, John, you remember the stock market was up, I think, 17, 18% in 2012. In fact, in 2013, the stock market was up 30%. So, you know, when you're making 20 and 30% in the stock market, it's easy to think that you can live a lifestyle like that. Unfortunately, we know what happened. The last great return for the stock market was in 2013. So they understood they really needed to make budget changes, and the first was downsizing their home, which they did. The other thing we had to point out, there's just no way with what they had with, you know, basically $15,000 a year of Social Security, even though they reduced their lifestyle dramatically to $35,000 a year with the paid for home, there was no way that we were going to be able to earn that kind of money. We were still going to be drawing down principal. So what we recommended is they both go back to work. And the other thing we did is they were carrying a lot of expensive insurance, whether it was life insurance, disability insurance, which was no longer necessary. So we got rid of some of the insurance, and we did switch to term policy because basically there just wasn't enough money to carry them both from retirement. Again, remember, John is 66, Judy is 59. Judy could live another 35, 36 years. So based on their investment profile, we saw several issues. Number one, they had to reduce the amount of money that they were withdrawing from their assets because simply they would run out of money at their present rate in about 7 years, and that scared the heck out of them. Secondly, they needed to invest more for, let's say, blue chip stocks and growth because they simply didn't have the assets or accumulated assets, nor enough Social Security income to get them through their retirement years. I mean, you know, as I told them, I said, you know, what are you going to do when you get in your 70s, when medical expenses really start to rise, and especially the age difference of 7 years between John and Judy? So that was an issue that we had to deal with. And then also making changes to their lifestyle. What we recommended, because their Social Security benefits were too low, because John basically took his benefits at age 62, so only got 75% of what his benefits should be, we recommended that they both work and that Judy allow her Social Security to accumulate to age 70 so that not only she would get more working credits in, but also her benefits would be a lot higher. And what we determined, they needed to make between $18,000 and $20,000 a year of work. Now, the unfortunate thing is at first, it didn't go over very well, but, you know, John recognized the reality. Judy, on the other hand, you know, they just had their first grandchild, and Judy envisioned staying more at home and taking care of babysitting the grandchild. So, you know, I basically said, look, I can't tell you who has to do this or whether you both have to do it, but we need to supplement retirement. You cannot retire on your Social Security income drawing the money you are right now, because like it or not, 7 years from now, you're going to end up broke. So in this case, John went back to work, and Judy agreed that she would try to look for some kind of part-time employment to ease the burden. I said, actually, you know, $18,000 to $20,000 is kind of the minimum. It would actually be better if you could actually make more than that. In other words, what if you could make $25,000, $30,000 and actually put some money aside, build up an emergency cash reserve, start putting money aside for medical expenses? So this was one of the things that we looked at. And the other thing that we also suggested is at some point, you know, you have a four-bedroom house. It's 2,300 square feet. But, you know, do you really need 2,300 square feet for bedroom? Since the kids live away, you know, you might want to consider even downsizing even more into a condo at $200,000 and freeing up $200,000 to add to the portfolio. But that's sort of like on the back burner at this point. So it was basically a very, very hard experience to go through, but there was a reality check. And that reality check is, guys, you're going to run out of money and be broke halfway through your retirement years. And so choice was, number one, downsize the house, which they did. I still think that they should have gone into a condo, but that may be on the back burner. Number two, go back to work. And I suggested both of them go back to work, especially Judy building up Social Security credits and also allowing her Social Security to grow deferred until age 70, a dramatic cut in their lifestyle, which they realized they had to do. So there was budget and downsizing. And on the back burner, John, in a couple of years, if we do not have enough cushion built up and they do not bring in enough earned income to supplement the retirement, because they really at this point should not touch their retirement assets and allow that to build back up again instead of drawing it down, because it's going to have to last them for, in their case, another 20 to 25 years.
You know, this is a reality that more and more people are going to have to cope with. And Jim, are you actually seeing more of it?
Sure. I mean, we had the case last week where we talked about an individual that had a two-bedroom retirement home and had to really get out of that two-bedroom retirement home because he could no longer afford it. Because in this situation, should the individual live long enough, and he was perfectly healthy at age 87, he could end up going broke. So, John, it's an issue that we are seeing more and more. I mean, you know, I've been in this business over 35 years, and I've seen a number of issues come up. One of them is we're seeing more cases of elder abuse today. Yeah, number two, just as the case of John and Judy, we're seeing more and more couples that are having to either go back to work or choosing prolonging retirement in working, whether it's part-time or full-time, in order to make up the assets, because the assets just aren't sufficient enough to support a retirement lifestyle. So, John, this has become a more and more part of the new reality of retirement today, where more and more couples are going to have to end up working, or in the case of John and Judy, they retired too early. In this case, they're going to have to go back to work. But thank goodness, it's still early on in their retirement years, and so we're making a major course correction here to fix this, but it is becoming a reality. And it's something we see a lot more of today.
And maybe one of the other things that seriously you have to consider here, based on everything we've said, is college education, especially for your kids. And so planning for college, even when you may not have kids yet, is an important thing to do, as we'll discuss coming up next with our guest, Kathy Ruby, college funding as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, in just about another month, you're going to have a lot of students graduating from high school. As parents, many will be looking at the cost of sending their children to school. And as we've known over the last couple decades, the cost of a college education has escalated over the years, becoming quite expensive, leaving many students with high debt burdens when they graduate. What can a parent do in terms of obtaining financial aid, and what is the best way to finance a college education? Joining me as my special guest today is Kathy Ruby. She's Director of College Finance at College Coach. And Kathy, why don't we begin, as parents are looking at financial aid cost or the cost of college, there are a lot of financial aid packages that are out there, and sometimes that can be confusing. Why don't we start with the basics? What should they be looking for when they're looking at a financial aid package?
Okay, well, lots of things to be looking at. And I'm assuming at this point they've already applied for admission and they've got a financial aid award in front of them. So when they're looking at a financial aid award, of course, the first thing to understand is how much does the college cost? So most colleges will list their costs, their tuition and their fees and their room and board. Those are the direct costs that a family will be responsible for. But then some colleges will also list indirect costs on a financial aid award. So they'll include things like books and personal expenses and transportation. And those estimates can really vary from college to college. But it's important, I think, as you're looking at a financial aid award, to keep in your mind, what are the costs to attend that particular school? And then what are the discretionary sort of personal costs that are going to be there no matter what college my child goes to? So that's the first step. And then to look at the different types of aid that are offered. The first type, of course, the best kind of money are grants and scholarships. which are the money that doesn't have to be repaid, right? The free money. And when you're looking at a grant and a scholarship that's been offered, you really want to understand why it was offered. Was it based on academic merit or was it based on financial need? And that's a pretty important distinction. The difference being, academic merit scholarships are awarded based on your child's academic profile as they relate to other students at that college. And so for those kinds of awards, usually there's a GPA requirement that is attached to that scholarship in order for it to be renewed every year. So, of course, when you're looking at a financial aid award, you want to always have in the back of your mind, what's this going to look like for 4 years, right? So academic scholarships generally have a GPA requirement attached. So you're going to want to understand what that GPA requirement is and whether or not it's reasonable. I mean, is it 3.8 or is it 3.0? There's a big difference there. So academic merit scholarships, understanding that piece. And then when it comes to need-based grants, those are grants that are awarded based on your family's financial situation, based on income, assets, your household size, how many kids in your household are enrolled in college. So you really want to read through the terms and conditions of the award to find out how likely it is that that grant's going to be renewed every year. Most colleges will say things like, you know, as long as your financial situation stays the same each year, you can expect that this grant will be renewed. But for some families, they may know their income is going to go up, or maybe they have two kids in college right now, but they know the older one's going to graduate. So if you're anticipating financial changes in the upcoming 4 years, you're going to want to contact that financial aid office to see if they can give you an idea of how that might affect a need-based grant that's been awarded. So when it comes to the grants and scholarships, it's all about renewability.
So I know some colleges have different aid packages. One would be like for outright scholarship grant where they cover the cost of education, books, and housing. Other colleges offer what they call some kind of work program where part of the cost required that the student do some kind of work on college. Can you explain the differences in these kind of different aid packages? In other words, outright, let's say, coverage of the cost, a loan, or a work program?
Yes. So grants and scholarships, of course, the best kind because it's free money that doesn't have to be repaid. Work obviously requires some effort on the student's behalf. So work study is sometimes offered as part of a financial aid package. And the reason it's considered financial aid is that the government actually gives money to schools to help them pay students who work on campus. So the students who are offered work study on campus are usually students who have financial need because colleges prioritize that needy students get that money first. And so when you see a work study award within a financial aid award, what that amount represents is the maximum that the student's going to be allowed to earn. So it's usually something like $2,000 or $3,000. And so your next questions are, you know, how many hours a week will my student have to work to earn that? Is it 10 hours a week? Is it 15 hours a week? So you'll have to read through the terms of the award to find out what their wage rate is. You'll also want to find out how easily can my student get a job? Because that answer really varies from college to college. Because some colleges will assign every student who has work study, they'll assign them a job. But more commonly, colleges will say, okay, you have work study. That gives you the right to go find a job on campus using this, you know, online student employment board or whatever it might be. So you really want to ask those questions about how does my student find a job? How many hours a week will they have to work to earn this money? The important thing to know about work study is that that award is not guaranteed. The student has to actually work to earn that money. And then most colleges actually don't let you apply the money directly to the bill because they know that sometimes kids don't earn what they think they're going to earn. So usually that money, it's a part-time job and the student gets paid couple times a month or once a month, and that money is usually used to help pay for books and personal expenses, but it's not necessarily used to pay the bill at the college. So that's what work study is. Now, also important to know, if you were not offered work study in a financial aid award, that doesn't necessarily mean that your student can't work on campus because, as I said, work study is awarded to needy students, and many colleges have more jobs available than they have needy students to fill them. So many times they'll open up student employment to anybody who wants to work. It may just be that work study students get priority in hiring, and then other students can go find jobs that are not offered to work study students. Having worked in several colleges, I can tell you that full service jobs are often open in colleges. So it's not a place that a lot of kids love to work, but it can be a place where you can get the hours that you need and earn the money that you want to earn. So I think another thing for parents to think about is that there is actually research that shows that kids who work in school and college actually do better academically. And when we say that, we don't mean working 20 or 30 or 40 hours a week, but 10 to 15 hours a week is a way that it helps students structure their time. Because when they get to college, you know, they're only in class 15 hours a week and they think they've got lots of time. So having a job helps them structure their time. It gives them another connection to their college that's different from their faculty-student interactions. Lots of good reasons to work, and there are a variety of ways to do it. So for families who don't have work study in their award, they can certainly approach the student employment office at a college to find out about what other kinds of jobs are available.
When we're talking about financial aid, are there any tips or special things a parent or a student may do that may increase their likelihood of getting a financial aid offer?
Yes, there definitely are things they can do. I think when families ask me, how can I maximize the chance of my student getting a scholarship or grant to help pay for college? My response is always, it's all about the list of colleges that your student applies to. So when it comes to getting financial aid, while certainly the government plays a role in providing student loans and providing grants to very needy families, the colleges themselves are the biggest source of money, really. So understanding how a college awards their financial aid is key to maximizing how much your student will get. And there are a couple of themes there. Now, we've talked about there are need-based grants and scholarships, and those are based on your family's ability to pay. And then there are also merit scholarships that colleges offer, and those are based on your student's academic profile within the profile of students who are at that college. So let's focus on merit scholarships first. Colleges offer scholarships to students to entice them to enroll. I mean, that's the market reality of it. We like to think scholarships are offered to reward our kids' great achievements, and that is true, but they're also offered to entice students to enroll. So, you know, every college has a profile of their students, and they're always trying to build that profile. So where your child is most likely to receive scholarships is at the colleges where they're most likely to get in. So as your child is putting together their list of colleges that they're considering, you know, college admission experts will tell you, you want to have a group of colleges that are going to be no problem for your student to get into, and then you want to have a group that are sort of just right. They're on target, sort of a 50-50 chance. And then, of course, all students have their challenging or their reach colleges that they're working toward. But the colleges that are no problem for your student to get into, where their profile, what their test scores, their GPA, their academic profile is in the top quartile of students admitted at that college, and that college has a selectivity rate that makes your student very attractive to them, those are the places that are the most likely to award scholarships to your student. The colleges where they're reaching for, those colleges know that they don't have to offer much money to entice your kind of student to enroll because they're a reach college for that student. So it's all about having a well-shaped list. I have a friend who describes it as a pyramid, to have, you know, a few colleges, four colleges that are no problem, and then maybe three that are just right, and then two that are reaches. There's no exact number there, but you get the idea.
So when applying for these scholarships, you said there's some on merit, there's academic scholarships, but also aren't there need scholarships as well?
Yes, absolutely. So colleges administer need-based financial aid, and certainly I think that's the more traditional kind of aid that we hear about. And need-based financial aid is awarded based on a somewhat simple formula at first, but it gets more complicated than that. So colleges assess your financial need or determine your family's financial need by starting with their cost of attendance. So each college is required to establish a cost of attendance that includes tuition and fees, books and personal expenses, and room and board, even if your student is living off campus. So important to remember, your student can receive financial aid for room and board, even if they're living off campus. So the college establishes this cost of attendance. And then in the meantime, you are completing financial aid forms. The main one is called the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It's filled out during the senior year of high school. and then every year afterward to be renewed. But it's called the FAFSA form, free application for federal student aid. And you as parents are reporting information about your income and your assets and your student's income and your student's assets. And then the government uses a formula called federal methodology, and they calculate what I call a magic number, the expected family contribution. You'll see it referred to as the EFC. Now, some private colleges require an additional form called the CSS profile form, and they use a different formula called institutional methodology. So there are about 350 of those colleges, and they tend to be wealthier, more selective private institutions who have more of their own need-based money to give away. And so they don't want to use the federal formula. They're choosing to use this institutional formula instead. So the EFC is calculated and it's subtracted from the cost of attendance. And then the difference is your student's financial need. So once that need has been established, so let's just say the college costs $65,000 a year, your EFC is $30,000, so the need is $35,000 a year. Now the key is, and it gets back to, it's all about the list and understanding how colleges award financial aid. The key is that not all colleges are able to meet that full demonstrated need. So while it's important to know what your EFC is, and there are calculators online that you can use, the College Board website is a great resource to go and get an estimate of your EFC. What's really important to know is, does the college meet full need, and do they meet full need for everyone? Or, coming back to, your student will do better at the school where they're a strong student. When a college can't afford to meet full need for everyone, the students they're most likely to meet full need for are the ones they want to enroll the most. So get an estimate of your EFC. That's a good first step as your student is beginning the college search process. And then the other great tool that families have available today is something called a net price calculator. And all colleges are required by the government to have a net price calculator. And it's a way that you can go to any college's website, enter your income and your assets and household information, and the college will generate an estimate of how much need-based financial aid you might receive. Now, it's not a perfect estimate. It's only as good as the information that goes in. And the other piece of that is that some colleges, they're not always able to incorporate merit scholarship eligibility within the net price calculator, but it's a good way for you to get a sense of what your eligibility for need-based financial aid is at different colleges.
Kathy, is there a site where you can find out, like, certain colleges will emphasize more merit, others may emphasize more need, or is it pretty much the same at most colleges, or is there really a differentiation between colleges in terms of how they award grants or aids?
That is a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because that is the crux of the issue, really. So the way I like to describe it is that there's a spectrum. And the most highly selective institutions in the country award little to no merit aid, but award very generous need-based financial aid packages. And so when you think about that, that kind of makes sense, right? Those schools don't have to entice anyone to enroll, but they have the resources to make generous need-based financial aid packages available. So the rule is the most selective institutions generally don't offer merit scholarships, but do offer generous need-based financial aid. But then there are hundreds of other institutions that offer merit scholarships and some need-based aid, but they just may not be able to meet need for everyone. So the way to get at that question is often by researching a college's website. Colleges that don't offer any merit scholarships will usually come right out and say, you know, we offer need-based financial aid, but do not offer merit scholarships. And then colleges that offer merit scholarships, which is really the majority, will often have information on their website about what their merit scholarships are, who might receive them. Some colleges are very transparent and will say, you know, if your test score is this and your GPA is this, you can expect this much in a scholarship. Other colleges will be more vague in their language about, you know, talking about high achieving students who will contribute to our community, those kinds of things. But you can get a sense on the website. The College Board website called bigfuture.collegeboard.org. You can look up any college and you can see the profile of students who are admitted there. And then there's some financial aid summary data as well that gives you an idea about whether they offer merit scholarships. I also encourage families to ask the question when they're visiting a college. You know, it's perfectly fine to ask in an information session, Do you offer merit scholarships, and can you give us an idea of what the profile is of the student who might be considered for merit scholarships? So it's really researching each institution individually, but there are some general rules out there that the most selective schools focus primarily on need-based aid and not merit scholarships.
You know, Kathy, I know when you're filling out financial aid forms and you talked about the FAFSA form, what are some of the common mistakes? And are there things, let me say, do's and don'ts that you don't want to do? In other words, are there certain things that you could do that maybe disqualify you for financial aid? And are there certain things that enhance getting that financial aid?
Well, I think the first and most important do is to meet deadlines. And the opposite of that is don't miss it. So each college, there are certainly commonalities among all the colleges. You know, all colleges will require the FAFSA for you to be considered for federal aid, including student loans. And then some colleges require the profile form. And then some colleges actually might have an institutional form. There's not very many of those, but there are some. And some may ask for tax returns throughout the process. But the first and most important thing is to research each college and make sure you're meeting the deadline, the priority deadline they've set for when they want those forms completed. Now, the process is changing starting next year. In the past, the FAFSA didn't become available until January 1st for the next year. So students who are seniors this year, they couldn't even fill out the FAFSA until January 1st to apply for next year. But starting next year, the form will become available October 1st instead. Now, as far as we know, most colleges aren't changing deadlines in significant ways. Most of the time, deadlines for need-based financial aid fall in the winter of the senior year, you know, usually February, March timeframe. So far, we haven't heard a lot of colleges changing their deadline, moving it earlier, but that doesn't mean you can't fill it out earlier, because you can, and it might give you earlier information depending on the college's process. In terms of ways to fill out the form to maximize eligibility, the formula that calculates EFC is heavily weighted toward income. So we hear a lot from families who are worried about how their savings are positioned. And we're going to talk about assets in just a sec. But the formula is heavily weighted toward income. And it's a pretty straightforward kind of a form. In fact, starting next year, because the form is available earlier, they're also asking for an earlier year of income. So when families are completing the FAFSA, they'll actually be able to just pull their income right from the IRS. So their income is what it is. So there's not much room for error there. When it comes to the asset side of the equation, on the FAFSA form, you're asked to report your assets as of the day that you're completing the form. So there's no look back. So anything that you spend prior to completing the form, no one's going to question you about that. So if you need to deplete any assets, if you have any major purchases, the time to do it is before you fill out the FAFSA. But when you complete the FAFSA, the instructions tell you do not include the equity in your primary residence, and do not include the value of retirement accounts. So if there's a mistake we saw people make sometimes, it was that they included those numbers when they didn't need to. For most families, actually, most of their wealth is probably in their home or in their retirement, and those two assets are not included on the FAFSA. So that's the beginning of some do's and don'ts.
Okay. And I know there's, as we mentioned, we talked about work programs and grants, scholarships. What about also bringing down the cost of, let's say, a college education? I know that a lot of colleges are offering online courses versus the brick and mortar where, you know, junior goes away to school, lives at a dorm. So you have not only tuition and book costs, but you also have room and board. What about online universities and getting aid for that? It seems like that would help to bring some of the cost down versus, let's say, staying on campus.
It certainly can bring the cost down. It really does depend on the university and what they're charging for their cost, and also what kind of aid they're offering. So what's really important is really what the net price is, obviously not the sticker price of what a college is charging. So yeah, I think online universities can be cheaper. They can be, but sometimes not. The other kinds of options, of course, are community college first and then going on to four-year colleges. I think in today's high school world, there are options that can result in college savings, things like dual enrollment, where students are enrolled in community college and high school at the same time. So they're earning credits toward a college degree. And then, of course, AP classes, advanced placement classes, and other college-level classes that are taken in high school. I think that is a great approach to take. but you will want to check with each college that your student is considering, because different colleges do have different rules about which of those courses they'll accept if you transfer them in for a four-year degree. But yeah, there's lots of creative ways to do it.
You know, we looked at this with a client of ours who had four children, and they simply just didn't have the money to send them all to college. So one of the things that we suggested is something we call our 2+2 program, where junior stays at home for 2 years, goes to a junior college at a cost of about $2,500 a year. So the first 2 years for an AA degree could be $5,000, and then a state school versus out of state or a private school where, you know, the cost may be $16,000 to $20,000. So you can get a college degree for $50,000 and less, and even online can bring that cost down even more.
Yes, for some families that can be the absolutely most affordable option. And I think to go along with that, I mean, certainly there are many states that have articulation agreements and other arrangements, you know, between the community college and the four-year state college to make sure. The general theme here is when the student goes to community college, they want to make sure that they're meeting with an advisor, that they're taking the right kinds of courses that will transfer, and that they're on a plan for the four-year degree. So they maximize those community college years and minimize the chance that it'll take them an extra semester once they get into the four-year college. But absolutely, that can be a way to save significant dollars.
You know, one of the other things that we're starting to see, and the Wall Street Journal has done a number of stories on this, a lot of the major corporations, whether it's General Electric or Apple, are working with junior colleges, and they're basically trying to come up with like a certificate programs. It reminds me back of the guild days back in the 14th century. So where you come up with some kind of program for 2 years and you come out with a skill set, whether it's computer programming, robotics or something, and can go work at, let's say, a factory and have the skill set to work in today's modern factories where robotics are taking over more of manufacturing. Are you seeing more of these kind of programs come out in the future?
Well, I don't know that I'm as well qualified to address that, but certainly I would imagine that that's something that's going to be growing in the future as we face the need for an educated workforce in particular ways. Certainly can see that happening more and more going forward. And given the rising cost of college and how it is harder and harder for middle-income families to afford. Absolutely.
So as we boil this down and kind of summarize, you mentioned a couple of key points, some do's and don'ts. One of the things that you pointed out, it's important that you meet the deadlines for filing these forms. And given that college starts, you know, usually at the end of August or early September, how much of a time frame do you have? What's the general deadline to have these applications for aid in? Obviously, if you're going to start college in the fall, you'd want to know that well in advance before attending.
Yes. Well, I will say that the traditional route for the student who's starting this August, most of the deadlines for institutional dollars anyway were in February or March of this year. And then the way the timing normally works or the process normally works is that students receive financial aid awards in March and April of their senior year. And then they have until May 1st to decide where to enroll. So the idea is that they know what it's going to cost by May 1st so that they can make their decision. Now, it is true at some state universities and certainly at community colleges, if you didn't apply by February or March, that doesn't mean you can't get money. If those colleges are awarding primarily federal and state aid or federal aid, you can still apply for federal aid this summer to attend in the fall. The issue, of course, with federal aid is that for most middle-income families, federal aid really means federal student loans. And lower-income families might qualify for federal grants. Many states, for state grant programs, they also have deadlines that fell in February or March, or sometimes a little later, of the senior year. So for kids starting this August, if you haven't applied for financial aid, certainly go ahead and do that now. But for families who are looking forward a year or two, do know that most of the time the deadlines fall during the senior year of high school so that you can get the information you need and have enough information to make an informed decision about cost and everything else by May 1st of your senior year.
As we close, Kathy, if our listeners would like to find out more about the assistance that your organization provides in attaining financial aid, how could they do so, please?
Our website is getintocollege.com is our website. So they can certainly access that website, and there's information there about how to contact our people.
Well, listen, Kathy, thanks for coming on the program and lending your assistance, because I imagine this is going to be a pretty big issue here in the next 30 days. Thanks so much, and all the best, and please come back and talk to us again.
Great to talk with you.
Something that came out of this conversation, Jim, is that college, the funding of it, first of all, it's become very, very expensive, but it's also complex in how this is achieved. And one of the topics we talk about on Lifetime Income are like multi-generational families living together. And you're almost getting into the point where you're having to do multi-generational retirement planning and take all of the picture into consideration, one of which, of course, is what you're going to do to pay for your kids' education. And you can't start too early on that.
No, and as we tried to point out in the program here, one of the key things is we talk about retirement planning on the program, but the real key is financial planning for the entire lifetime, because a lot of the key decisions that you make early on in your career, when you get out of high school, what college you attend, public, private, the profession you choose, and when you start saving, as well as your lifestyle through your working career, so much of this factors into retirement planning. Unfortunately, John, most people don't start talking about retirement planning until usually in their late 40s or early 50s when the kids have grown up, you put them through school, and you're thinking, you know, I'm 10, 15 years away from retirement. We better start thinking about it, when really the time to think about it is the day you start your first job coming out of college and the decisions that you make. But anyway, in the month of May coming up, we're going to cover more of the issues of college education. It is graduation time. So funding a college education is going to be on the minds of a lot of our listeners, and we're going to have special experts here on the program. You know, a couple of areas I want to get into is the cost of a private education really worth the cost? In other words, you're going to Harvard and you're going to spend, what, $260,000, $280,000. Is it worth it versus, let's say, a state university, or my own version of what I call affordable college, which is 2+2. We'll be getting more into that in the months ahead. In the meantime, well, we're out of time here on the program. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.